From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Most Americans experience the criminal justice system from a distance. They follow courtroom headlines about Terri Schiavo, Michael Jackson, the latest CEO conviction. For a few days this month, the nation was transfixed by the horrific courthouse shootings in Atlanta, but again, from a distance. And up close, says my guest tonight, it's a very different picture. Just ask the millions of Americans who are locked up in prisons and jails on any given day, or the millions more who work in the system, from clerks to judges. The cost to taxpayers to keep the wheels of justice turning, now more than $165 billion a year. But how is justice being served? Chicago journalist Steve Bogira wanted to find out. He spent a year at the busiest felony courthouse in the country, Chicago's Cook County Criminal Court, watching, listening, questioning everything and everyone, the judge, jury, cops, perps, everyone, day in and day out, in courtroom 302, Bogira saw thousands of defendants, men and women, all but invisible to society, move from lockup to trial to prison, leaving behind enormous trails of legal and moral questions about justice in America. Tonight on Point, a year in the life of a jammed American courtroom, justice, injustice, and the nation we live in now. You can join the conversation. You've seen the TV shows, but do you really know what goes on in America's courtrooms? Can you imagine a courthouse that processes 78,000 defendants a year? Is this system working? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Steve Bogira, staff writer for the Chicago Reader, where he spent the past 24 years writing a lot about urban poor. In 1998, he spent a year in one courtroom in Chicago's Cook County Criminal Courthouse, the busiest felony courthouse in the country, as he describes it. His new book about that experience is Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. Steve Bogira, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Nice to be here with you tonight, Tom.
So this terrain was not strange terrain for you in general. If you've covered poverty, you've seen crime. But you went right into the courtroom. Why, Steve?
Well, I find the courtroom a fascinating place. There's a lot on the line in felony courtrooms like these. As you mentioned, there are more than 2 million people locked up right now in America. Every one of them comes through a criminal courtroom like the one I focused on. Yet we know so little about what happens in those courtrooms. So I thought it was a good opportunity to try and let us know, help people find out what life is like in one of those courtrooms.
I want you to tell us stories, lots of stories tonight from that year of watching, but maybe we should begin at what I assume is kind of the baseline of perception for most Americans, and it grows off of television. I mean, you look at the real estate on TV every night, and it's law and order, trial, justice, investigation. It's the legal system all over the place. As a kind of paint a broader picture here for us, Steve, of what we see on TV versus what you found in the actual process, in the actual system, as it works, as it is.
Well, on TV, Tom, we see usually jury trials, first of all, and they're usually conducted before packed galleries. In reality, in the average criminal courtroom, at least in big city courtrooms, the vast majority of cases are plea bargains. And when there are trials, they're often conducted before nearly empty galleries. A lot of times the defendant's family doesn't even show up. So there is a lot of drama, but it's not the kind of drama we see on TV.
You describe this courthouse, of course, it's an old one, I think built in 1929 or something like
that. That's right. It opened on April Fool's Day, 1929.
There on Chicago's southwest side, a Mexican neighborhood today?
That's right. Before 1929, the courtroom was downtown in downtown Chicago. It was moved out to the southwest side, a really out-of-the-way area because the city's leaders didn't want the riffraff downtown.
And you write, it's got these great Doric columns, Latin phrases carved above them, and these eight sculpted figures above the columns representing law, of course, in the great architectural tradition of American public buildings, law, justice, liberty, truth, might, love, wisdom, and peace. How much of those did you find inside this courthouse?
It's easier to carve those words into limestone than it is to put them into action. Yeah, you find law in the courthouse, but not a whole lot of peace and love. And justice, of course, is a word like love. I guess it's very ambiguous. It depends on who's using it. Some people mean retribution when they're talking about justice. Some people mean fairness. So it's really hard to assess how much justice there is. But I didn't see a whole lot of evenness. Right from the very start, when people walk into the entrance, you see white people using their badge or ID and walking straight into the courthouse because most of them are employees. And you see black people going through the metal detectors because most of them are there because either they have a case and they're out on bond, or they're the family members of somebody who's on trial, or they're the family members of a victim, or they are a victim, or they're witnesses. But fewer of those people actually work in the building. So there's this racial divide right at the entrance. Mm.
The Washington Post read your book and described it as a chronicle of damnation. It sounds like something from the circles of hell here, and yet it's not all so grim, but it's tough. You've got deception that you're describing here, sometimes on the part of police officers, suppressed evidence, corruption, people pleading guilty just to get out of jail. They're too poor to pay for bail. We should begin to take us in here. Describe the courtroom you sat down in and what you saw there day after day.
Well, the courthouse has 7 floors of courtrooms. There are 32 felony trial courtrooms. The courtrooms on the top 4 floors are the older Perry Mason-style courtrooms. They're big and elegant and trimmed in oak. In 1970, courtrooms were added on the 2nd and 3rd floors, and those are cramped. There's bulletproof glass separating the gallery from the rest of the courtroom, from the front of the courtroom, and courtroom 302 is one of those. It's very claustrophobic. There's no windows, and, you know, there's a feeling of unwelcomeness. There's a tenor in the courtroom itself and in the hallways, too. In the hallways, there are no benches for people to sit who are waiting. There's just lots of signs on the walls saying don't do this and don't do that, and this is prohibited and that is prohibited. It's different from the federal courtroom downtown, where there are benches in the hallways and things are kept cleaner and it's more welcoming. But the trials of the people who come to state courts, there's something that says we don't want you.
And it starts right away. You've got a great passage at the beginning of the book where you describe kind of a paddy wagon unloading men down to the basement induction center or the place where new prisoners
where they get
are received.
Where they get their baptism.
Describe that baptism for us. To take us through what it's like to be welcomed or unwelcomed in to this Cook County Courthouse.
The people are dropped off, as you say, by the paddy wagons, and immediately the deputies start setting the tone, as they call it, by cursing them out and screaming at them, issuing a group of laws that they are, or rules that they are supposed to follow. The number one rule is hands behind the back at all time. If your hands ever come out, you're going to get whacked. If you don't follow the rules, you're going to end up in the jail hospital. Those are the kinds of things that the deputies say to the new prisoners.
And you describe one deputy, you call him Bullneck, saying, "You don't scare me, you don't intimidate me, and you sure don't impress me." And I'm cleaning that up a little bit, but it's laid on the line right away.
Right. And there was another defendant the night I was there who called rather innocently from one of the lockups to a deputy and said, "When is the public defender coming by?" And the deputy's response was, "Number one, I don't know. Number two, I don't care. Number three, you're guilty." And that is the prevailing attitude among the deputies. Of course, defendants are cloaked in the presumption of innocence according to our Constitution, but in reality, they're pretty much considered to be guilty by the deputies and other people in the courthouse. The attitude is, if you're so innocent, why did you wind up here in handcuffs?
Well, I mean, am I being... I mean, I'm assuming these aren't choir boys and girls who are being brought in here by and large, or is that a misperception?
Well, they're not choir boys, but they're also not all violent gangbangers. In fact, the vast majority are not. Most of them have been picked up because they got caught with a rock of cocaine or a bag of heroin on a street corner. Talking to the deputies, they said in the 1980s, there was a more violent bunch. And there was a greater need for stronger control of the new prisoners. But those patterns die slowly, I guess, because now, even though the deputies admit that most of the new prisoners are pretty docile, they continue with their baptism.
Steve Bogira, stand by. We've got to take a short break here, but it's great to have you with us tonight. Steve Bogira's new book is Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse, a very busy, very big one in Chicago, in Cook County. Listeners, you can join our conversation tonight. You've seen the TV shows, but do you really know what goes on day in and day out in America's courtrooms? Can you imagine a courthouse that processes 78,000 defendants a year? Do you take it for granted that the American judicial system works? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a year in the heart of the American criminal justice system, about stories of crime and punishment from a jammed courthouse in Chicago, and what they tell us about justice, injustice, and the country we've become. My guest is Steve Bogira. He is author of the new book, Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. You can join the conversation. Do you have firsthand experience of it? Was it fair? Was it just, this system? And has the criminal justice system become, in effect, such as it is, the national safety net, the cleanup crew? What's the message in the daily grind of America's courts? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Steve, I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I may. Phil is calling from New York City. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Big burden to be first. I'm an attorney in New York. I do civil and commercial matters. I got caught up. I was falsely arrested by New York's finest. They made a couple of big mistakes, but I got to see the system from the inside, and it was a revelation.
Inside as in jail, in the court system?
I spent almost a month in jail because of false arrest, the malicious prosecution by one of the local DAs. I'm in federal court now suing the city.
What did you learn, Phil?
Well, I learned that the system is completely corrupt, incompetent, and amazingly racist. Bail is, even low bails, they put $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, $50,000 bails on poor black and Latino kids for smoking a joint or doing something minor when they should have been given an appearance ticket. Apparently, and I don't know how it is in Chicago, but the city gets paid that summer $45 a day for every inmate it had in its local jails, and it has about, I don't know, 10,000, 12,000 jail cells.
So they're incented to keep them full? So
they make tens of millions of dollars a year. They round them up and push them through. In the county I was in, I got to see judges who wouldn't listen to attorneys, drugs being dealt in the local jail.
Phil, and you're an attorney, and it was still surprising to you.
Well, I was... Unfortunately, and I don't want to give too many specifics because it would be well known. It was
fine,
in the media,
fine. Mm-hmm.
But and I'm trying to keep it on the down low, as the people would say. But quite frankly, it was a living nightmare. But it was even worse. There were guys in jail on minor crimes being held. It's really just it's just unbelievable. And the people in America should really revolt against the criminal. You know, this prison industrial complex, and it's extremely racist. I'm a white guy. I'm a middle-class guy.
But you saw it up close and personal, and we hear it, Phil. We thank you. There's the testifying from New York, Steve Bagheera. Does that ring true to your experience in Chicago?
Except for the incentive part. I don't think that we have an incentive system like that here, but in the course of researching my book, I found a study from 1922 of the Cook County system, which talked about bail as discriminating against those without money and denouncing this blatant economic discrimination, noting that it relegated to jail mostly the poor and the friendless. That was in 1922, and this is more than 80 years later, and we still have the same system of bail. Basically, if you've got money, you can be out of jail until your case is disposed of, at least. And if you don't, you're going to be in jail those months in a lot of circumstances.
But here's Phil. He's an attorney. He hadn't had this experience before. He's thrown in jail. We don't know the details. It doesn't sound fun. But maybe he's the stand-in for many of our listeners tonight. And he says once he was on the other side of the looking glass, it looked and felt to him like a living nightmare. Is that the reaction that you think a lot of Americans would have to what you observed, or is that more extreme? I mean, after all, Phil was in there for a month.
I think it is the reaction that a lot of Americans would have. But
why?
Again, we get back to the racial divide. The people who pick up the phone tend to be middle class and call a program like this. People who are poor don't do that. And most of the people in jails and in prisons are poor. They are not connected, so they don't have much of a voice, and consequently, people are able to do whatever they're going to do without people noticing. In Cook County, behind the courthouse I'm writing about, the jail is right there. For years, it held 1,000 or 2,000 people. Now, largely because of the drug war, there are more than 10,000 people in the jail, so it's bigger than a lot of cities. There's no press in that jail. I had access for my book occasionally to come into the jail. But you can imagine a city that had no press, what kinds of things would happen in it.
And you've got a big list. I mean, and I wish you'd give us some examples of this, but you're talking about a culture of deception. Deception, as you describe, among police officers that judges more or less roll with. Well, that's a kind of allegation. Put some meat on the bones. Is it true?
The place you see it most often is in confessions that are coerced from defendants. We hear about physical abuse, torture by detectives to extract confessions. I don't think that happens nearly as much today as it did in years past, but I think there's a lot of psychological coercion that is put on defendants to get them to confess. And judges look the other way when this is raised by defense lawyers. A lot of times you'll have, I had a case in the book where a guy named Dan Young, who had an IQ in the lower 50s, his lawyer was saying, challenging whether he could have intelligently waived his Miranda rights. His lawyer said he would have said what the police wanted him to say in exchange for an M&M. He had given a confession to a murder. The defense lawyer put on three psychologists who all said he couldn't have waived his Miranda rights intelligently. But there was a prosecutor who had interviewed Mr. Young at the time he gave his confession, who had worked with retarded kids in a summer camp for one summer. And he said, oh, I think he understood. So the judge went with the prosecutor who had worked in the summer camp over the three psychologists because he didn't want that confession to be tossed.
And on went
The defendant was convicted of murder, served 14 years. He got a life sentence. He served 14 years last month, partly because of DNA evidence that has since surfaced. He was freed. The state's attorneys dropped the case.
After all those years, you write about suppression of evidence. Give us an insight there.
Well, a lot of times evidence is seized improperly by police, most often in drug cases, and judges, again, overlook what they know a lot of times is false testimony by police. Police don't have a right to just come up to someone on a street corner, suspect that he might have drugs on him, and search him. But often that's what they do, and since they can't do that and can't say they did that in court, what they say is that the defendant dropped the drugs to the street. Police report after police report reads, defendant dropped drugs to the street, and judges know that this is frequently perjury by police, but they look the other way because they don't want the defendant to get off.
So the dynamic here is, I mean, they're there to fight crime, and there's a presumption that the flow coming in is very likely tainted with crime, and so they're going to stand up and push back. I mean, maybe that's what these judges feel like they're appointed, elected to do.
I think you're right, Tom. I think that's what they often feel. But judges take an oath to uphold the Constitution, and reading between the lines and trying to get to the end, in other words, well, I am pretty sure this guy is guilty, is a dangerous thing to do, not only because innocent people get convicted when judges start doing that, but because I think there's an integrity to the system that is lost when we say we need to bend the law in order to enforce the law. I think it develops a great cynicism among the poor that the deck is stacked against them.
And I have to say, reading through this, Steve, I felt, yes, there's an element of crime fighting here, but there's also just a kind of bureaucratic moving the cases. Let's move them through. Let's keep them moving. Let's move them, move them, move them, where the pace and the volume moved was sometimes more important than any details.
Yeah, and that's always been true. That's, again, the research I did from years past. Dispositions in Cook County were important at least as far back as 1920 and probably earlier than that. And it's gotten much worse in recent years because of all the drug cases coming into the system. There are just courtrooms are overwhelmed, not just here in Chicago, but in big city courtrooms throughout the country. Judges are feeling under great pressure to get rid of cases, and so they do, as you say, whatever they can to get the case out of the courtroom as quickly as possible and get to the next one.
And yet they feel that demand from the population to clamp down on crime, and there's the tension right there. We've got a lot of callers waiting to join us. Let's turn to them. William is calling from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Hi, William. You're on the air.
Yes. I'm a physician. I work in a women's prison. And I'd like to make some points.
Please.
One of them is that one of the major things about when the people get discharged, the inmates get discharged, there's very little resources for mental health, substance abuse available for them. And I see them within a couple of weeks right back, usually.
The revolving door.
Yes. But then on the other hand, I have yet to meet an inmate that denies doing the crime. They may minimize some of it, but I have yet to meet somebody who basically says I'm innocent. And if they do, it's initially before the court hearing, and then once it's been pleaded, of course, then they are much more honest with me, and not that they have to be. But
William, I want to be sure I understand you. You're saying you've never met a defendant who says they're innocent? Is that what you mean to say?
Yes. And now
or you've never met one who says they're guilty?
I'm saying no. Many of them say they're guilty.
Really?
Absolutely.
I mean, they're confessing to the crime.
Absolutely, but they don't confess until it's taken care of. I tell them strictly that it could be possibly their mental health records. There's a possibility it could be used against them before the trial or their plea bargain. So we don't talk about that very much. But after they plea bargain, which is usually the case, many of them admit to that crime, and oftentimes they've gotten away with several other crimes before. And sometimes most of them say they're going to get out and use drugs again, which is terrible, but the resources are not available there after they get out to help them out.
William, you're a physician. You say you deal with their mental health?
Yes.
And do you see mental health problems as common?
I see them as, yes, absolutely. 50%, I would say, in my opinion, have some type of anxiety disorder, depressive disorder, personality disorder, and substance abuse problem is much higher, of course, percentage-wise. Many of them are in there for substance for drug related crimes, but oftentimes it's oftentimes a violent crime in order to get money for drugs and also repeat offenders are the one thing that is really inappropriate. I'll see somebody that's been in there shoplifting 30 times and all of a sudden they got 3 years. I mean, that's I don't think that's fair. That's probably one of the most unfair aspects.
They've shoplifted 30 times in 3 years is too much. I mean, that's a lot of shoplifting 30 times.
Well, I'm just saying it's usually, you know, things $10, $15, stuff like that.
Three years seems heavy from your perspective.
Absolutely. I mean, that shoplifting is not a major. I'll see somebody that, but then again, there's people that repeat offenders when it comes to drug use and such. They get much more years, and it's usually been, 10 times on charges of, and these are vague. You know, I don't see their complete legal record, but I've...
Yeah, but we've got the picture. Let me put it to Steve. Steve, I wonder, particularly on this issue of how defendants plead, you know, in the plea bargaining, the guilt and innocence, their sense of their own guilt or innocence and their expression of it, as you saw it in the judicial system, is there a norm you can point to?
Well, I think I agree with a lot of what William's saying. People have the idea that defendants are always going to say, "I didn't do it," and there are a lot of defendants who say that. But there are a lot of defendants who will also be honest with you about what they did. And you know, he also talked about mental health problems being rampant, and I certainly saw that as true. We had this big deinstitutionalization movement in the 60s and 70s, and the promise was that people would be would have a better chance at life if they were living in the community instead of mental hospitals, and that money would be provided to help them live in the community. So they were deinstitutionalized, but the money was not provided. So now they've been reinstitutionalized in jails and prisons. And so that, you know, really our biggest mental hospitals right now are our jails and prisons.
You described this plea bargaining process in this one story I remember where the defendant is absolutely insisting, and it's not in a very formal setting, but that he's innocent. But he sees how many years could be laid on him if he gets into an antagonistic relationship here, and he agreed to something like, as I recall, 6 years out of fear. And again, he's saying he's innocent. I wonder what you thought of that. But out of fear that if he fought the system, he might get 15 or 20 years. So it was a kind of a rolling over for 6 years just out of fear that if he didn't, it could be much worse and he didn't have the means to defend himself.
That defendant, Tony Cameron, was charged with armed robbery, and I don't think he was innocent. In fact, he told me that he had done the crime. The point of that story was that he was a guy who'd been in psychiatric hospitals 16 times. He was manic depressive. He may have been schizophrenic. The system didn't know how to deal with Tony Cameron. You mentioned earlier, you described the courthouses as possibly being our safety net. I think of them as being our landfill. It's where we bury our problems. My book is not about, for the most part, about innocent defendants who are getting railroaded. Mm-hmm. That happens. But the bigger part of the story, I think, is the neglect, our neglect of people who are basically refuse to us, people like Tony Cameron, who we don't know how to deal with, or we're not interested in dealing with. That the basement of the courthouse that I talked to earlier, there was a watch commander who said, "I let my sergeant run the show down here." This watch commander didn't want to know what was going on. He said, "An occupational hazard of my job is the stiff neck I can get from looking the other way." Well, I think a lot of us in America have a stiff neck from looking the other way. I think we have to decide what other ways are there available to us to deal with these problems that we have, these people who are struggling in life, other than just passing a law and trying to warehouse people.
So you're saying justice done in a narrow sense, but if you broaden the screen and look at what's going on here, well, the temptation is to look away.
Yeah, it's real hard. I mean, there are places in this book where I definitely find fault with how the courts work. But I also feel like that's the smaller part of the problem, that we're not going to have justice inside a courthouse until we have justice outside of courthouses.
Steve Bagheera in Chicago, please stand by. Steve Bagheera's new book is Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Is the courthouse the new American landfill, his word, of ruined American lives? And when the volume is so high, are we doing justice or just processing cases? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about stories of crime and punishment from a jammed courthouse in Chicago and what they tell us about justice, injustice, and the country we've become. My guest tonight, Steve Bagheera. His new book is Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. You can join us tonight. Does this sound like law and order to you? And when America has the world's highest incarceration rate, does that mean the system is working or failing? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mark's calling from Boston. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask your guest to comment on basically someone in my family is a DA here in Massachusetts.
Yep.
And so I hear a little bit about what goes on in terms of the kind of resources that the court has available to them in order to deal with the, you know, tremendous flood of cases that they see and to deal with all the different problems that come into district court.
Are you saying they're doing their best with what they've got, Mark? Is that the angle?
Yeah. Well, what I'm wondering is I'm wondering if your guest can speak a little bit about, at least in the Chicago courtroom, how he felt the limited resources the court has at their disposal plays into sort of the different things that he saw as either unjust or improper according to the Constitution.
Great. Let's pick it up. Mark, thanks for your call. Steve, how about it? Resources, how do they play in or lack thereof?
Well, Mark raises a key issue. Across the country, state's attorneys, district attorneys, public defender staffs, judges are all saying we need help. We need more money. We need more of us to be able to process these cases. If we had more of us, we could give individual cases more time. And I think that's true. There's a danger, though, and that is historically, the larger the system gets, the more crime that magically seems to occur to fill that system. In the early 90s, there were some specialized drug courts created here in Chicago, and the idea was that they would process cases faster. They got really good at processing cases faster, and because they did, police who used to look the other way if they caught somebody with sneeze and it's gone amount of cocaine or heroin or a little marijuana, they used to look the other way because they knew the judges would throw the cases out because they didn't have time to process those cases. Now with a few extra drug court judges, they could process those cases. So they arrested those people. The number of defendants swelled and people didn't have any more time for more cases.
So you're saying the more resources get pumped in, the more folks are going to end up in the dock?
That's right.
It's like a magnet for more volume of alleged criminals?
Exactly, Tom. That's happened historically. So if we could somehow raise the number of staff without raising the number of defendants, but we don't seem to do that, there does seem to be an incentive here. There are a lot of jobs in the criminal justice system, and the more defendants you have, the more jobs. So I think that's a factor.
A lot right there in the Cook County Courthouse. You write about corruption, even overt corruption. Like what?
Well, I talked about some of it before. I don't think overt corruption is as big a problem now. I talked about judges who were prosecuted here in Cook County in the 1980s. Mm. But I think now that kind of thing, the kind of thing that was happening, which was judges taking money to fix cases, I'm not saying that would never happen. I'm sure that that can happen from time to time, but I don't think that kind of thing happens as much anymore. I'm more concerned with the day-to-day corruption with a small c, which is what I was speaking to earlier about judges looking the other way about coerced confessions and those kind of things.
And what about the judge in courtroom 302, Judge Daniel Locallo?
Yes.
Am I pronouncing it correctly?
Yes, that's right.
You got this great line. You say, the overnight crime reports always interest him. They're like coming attractions.
He listens to the radio and he hears about these crimes and he thinks about, oh, I might get that case in my courtroom. A lot of judges do that. Locallo is different because he wants to get what is called a heater case, a case that has press attention, because he finds those cases challenging and he likes the publicity. But a lot of judges don't like to get heater cases because you can get burned by a heater case. If a case is in the news and you make a decision that's politically unpopular, judges have to run for retention, at least in Chicago they do, and you might put your retention in jeopardy.
Did the chemistry in the courtroom change when you got a heater case, when the cameras and press showed up?
Yeah, it absolutely did. The heater cases get a lot of time. Usually you have defendants with money, and so they have the best lawyers. And as you're saying, the press show up. Everybody's on their best behavior. The judge and the clerk and the deputy tend to get haircuts before the jury trial starts. It's quite different from the day-to-day activity in the courtroom.
And do you think there's a higher quality of justice when everybody perks up under the Klieg lights? Or not?
Yeah, it's funny because it works both ways. I think it is everything is thought through more carefully, but decisions sometimes can be made based on what is considered politically expedient. So it's a double-edged sword.
Cuts both ways when the lights go on. Susan's calling from Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a story about a young woman in prison. I was teaching in the women's prison in Raleigh, and the warden was escorting me, and there's this pregnant woman who came up to talk to her while we were walking along our way, and I casually asked, why was this pregnant woman in prison? And she goes, well, she and her husband were caught out of season shooting a deer, and they were both put in prison. I said, for shooting a deer out of season, and they couldn't pay the $250 fine.
Sounds like something out of Sherwood Forest and Robin Hood, Susan.
Yes, and so these are a perfect example of people who didn't have the resources, were too poor. They were shooting this deer out of season because they were hungry. And they had a two-year-old son and had to stay with relatives, and the husband was out of prison finally, but she had to serve more time.
How did that leave you feeling? What leave you thinking, Susan?
Well, I was pretty outraged, so I called the Attorney General's office the next day and kept screaming and yelling until I found the right people who actually helped and got her out of prison. Because that was my taxpayer dollar, you know, with her in the prison. And I just felt so badly for someone that they didn't have the resources or didn't know how to turn, where to turn to get help.
Susan,
they shouldn't have been in prison.
That's a story that turns a light of its own on. Thanks for sharing it. Steve, I suppose not much deer hunting going on in Chicago. But
yeah.
did you have the sense of people who, clearly you're going to have people who deserve to go to the slammer for you know, murder and mayhem, but did you have the sense of a significant volume of people that Americans like Susan might look and say, well, what's going on here?
Yeah, you're right, Tom. We don't have many deer shot here in Chicago, but we do have a lot of people who seem like deer caught in the headlights. One guy I write about in the book named Larry Bates, he was graduated high school, went to work in a pharmaceutical warehouse, he worked other warehouse jobs, never caught a criminal case until he was 42.
His wife had a psychotic breakdown, as I recall.
That's right. They had two children, and the second one, after she had a schizophrenic break, Larry's wife drowned in a diaper pail.
Drowned the child,
After that, Larry went downhill. He also lost his job, unrelated to this. It was the recession of right around 1980, and a lot of people, blacks in particular, were losing work, were losing their jobs. And he slid further and further downhill. Crack cocaine came into Chicago in a big way, as it did in many big cities in the 1980s, and Larry got hooked to crack cocaine and eventually got caught with some cocaine, arrested, and he got a felony conviction. Now, he only gets probation the first couple of times. A lot of times we hear in the press about these draconian sentences where somebody gets picked up and has a gram of cocaine and does 25 years.
Right.
That's not really typical. The problem is that it's a revolving door that defendants, the kind of progress they make is the kind of progress Larry Bates made. He goes from probation to a shorter short prison term to a longer prison term.
It's downward progress, downhill.
And yeah, and even people think probation is a slap on the wrist, but it's a felony conviction, which makes getting a job very difficult for the rest of a person's life. So Larry Bates goes into the system with a cocaine addiction. Going through the court proceeding doesn't really do anything to address that addiction. What he has at the end of that is an addiction plus a felony record. So I don't know how much is accomplished by that, but an awful lot of money is spent doing that.
So he's processed and processed, but in the end you see him as a kind of deer in the headlights. Tell us the story of D'Angelo Harris. That was also one that caught my eye, Steve. Rough story. I mean, rough crime, but rough story too.
D'Angelo was, I believe he was 17 when he shot someone to death who he thought was in a rival gang. And D'Angelo was tried for murder and pled guilty in the middle of trial when somebody came forward, a witness who said he did the shooting. D'Angelo was knocked around for most of his childhood. His mom was a cocaine addict herself, and D'Angelo really, for family, he was really raised by gangster disciples, like a lot of people, like a lot of young people in big cities.
You describe he was 12 years old, saw his father for the first time in 9 years, and his father said to him, "Don't call me Dad."
Yeah, he saw his father at his grandfather's funeral, and he said to him, "Everything's going to be all right, Dad." D'Angelo trying to comfort his father,
yeah.
His father gave that response, "Don't call me Dad." And I think that speaks volumes of what where a lot of defendants are coming from. You know, it's not saying what they do is right, but there was a moment also during that trial that I found striking. D'Angelo's mother went into the trial believing he didn't do it, but by the end of the trial, she realized he had done the crime. She was sitting on one side of the gallery, and the victim's mother was sitting on the other. And D'Angelo's mom stood. She walked into the aisle, and she caught the eye of the victim's mother, and she said, "I'm sorry about what my son did to your son." And there are moments like that. You know, there's a lot of depression in and dispiriting moments in a felony courtroom, but to me that was a golden moment. It meant something for D'Angelo's mom to say that, and I talked to the victim's mother later. It meant a lot to her for her to hear that.
Steve, you describe it as a landfill. There's a lot being dealt with here, a lot that has to be dealt with, but a lot that ends up in the courtroom because it's just not dealt with anywhere else in our social structure. So
that's right.
In the end, how do you come down on the many men and women working in this courthouse, on the system you saw there? Are you condemning that, or are you looking at the surround and saying they're doing the best they can with the tide that rushes in here?
I do think they are doing the best they can. The problem is not the prosecutors and the public defenders and the judges. The problem is us. You know, we put so much money into criminal justice, and the people who work in the system know that it doesn't change anything. If we really want to change, we have to do what we can to shrink that system, get out of the war on drugs to the extent we can, and put that money into where it makes a difference, which is fighting poverty and into early childhood programs and into employment programs so that people don't end up coming into these courtrooms in the first place.
Steve Bagheera, with that, we're out of time. We're grateful to you for being with us. Thank you so much for your time and the new book. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks for having me, Tom.
Steve Bagheera, author of Courtroom 302, A Year Behind the Scenes in an American Criminal Courthouse. This is On Point. when Birmingham, Alabama girls basketball coach Roderick Jackson noticed that his team had to practice on bent rims in a non-regulation gym while the boys' team got to use much nicer facilities, he cried foul. As a result of his complaints, he says, he was fired. Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled that Title IX, the law that demands equality for women's sports, protects whistleblowers like Jackson who complain about Title IX violations. Jackson has been rehired at the school that fired him. Today, he's being hailed as a hero. In this radio diary, Roderick Jackson reacts to yesterday's court ruling and recalls the conditions that led him to blow the whistle on the inequities in the school's athletic department.
Well, basically started with no access to the expensive towel, no access to the ice machine, no rotation with the main gymnasium. In other words, the girls couldn't get in on the early shift at least 2 days a week or 2 or 3 days a week. They had to wait to the last shift, which made it inconvenient for not only them and ride problem, but also made it bad for the coaches. And just a list of things like that. I mean, it's a laundry list. The girls' JV team was eliminated. The boys' JV played on. And so things like that. Being an ex-military guy, I was taught to work within the chain of command. And even in the system, you're encouraged to work with your immediate supervisor. And from there, go to the next higher step. And I did that first verbally. And then I finally started putting things in writing. And no response, and so I had to send some letters certified, and still no response. So, you know, as you probably already know, the negative evaluation started coming, and also I was fired in May of 2001. If you were in the situation and you had six students that went to college, five out of six graduated, one went to the Coast Guard, the girls won more games than their male counterparts during the two-year span, you would assume that there could be no other reason other than that. When the local and national media got involved and with the election of the new school administration as well as a new system administration, things couldn't help but get better. And so to the credit of those involved, I can say that the girls have been allowed to practice in the regulation gym and what have you. So some progress has been made. You have some people that are well-wishers and wishing you well and congratulating you now, rather. And you have your naysayers still who, although less, have expressed it, though, but I'm sure there's still some naysayers who feel like, you know, you're a rabble-rouser, you're a troublemaker, but the price for progress, it calls for sacrifice, and if I had to do all over again, I would do the exact same thing. I had no idea to go this far. I don't think that I could compare at all to Rosa Parks or people of that stature, but I was just one man trying to better the lives of my young people that I was charged with representing, and that's what I was trying to do. And so I just hope it helped somewhere down the line of not these particular young ladies, the young ladies to come, and people across the country.
Roderick Jackson coaches the girls' basketball team at Ensley Magnet High School in Birmingham, Alabama. He was the victorious plaintiff in yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, Jackson versus Birmingham Board of Education. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.